wherever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. And each night, we'll bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with solutions, the topics you want to hear, and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's do it together. Let's get to the heart of the issues that faces every day right here, right now on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast, and around the world on the BBS Radio Network.
All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance.
Richard Heinberg with us. He is the author of The End of Growth, Adapting to Our New Economic Reality. He's the author of about 9 previous books, including the best-selling The Party's Over, Peak Everything, and Blackout, a senior fellow at the Post Carbon Institute. Richard's one of the world's most foremost peak oil educators and an effective communicator of the urgent need to transition away from fossil fuels. And let's say, Richard, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. Good to be with you.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. When we talk about the end of growth, my goodness, what's been going on in the last week or so with Congress, with the House,
that
almost justifies everything that you're saying.
Well, it is pretty scary. Actually, the most recent economic news is a page right out of the book. We heard last Friday that GDP numbers for first quarter of 2011 have been adjusted downward, and that means that currently the U.S. economy is actually smaller than it was in 2007. And the current indicators are not good. Manufacturing levels are declining, and it looks as though we're poised for more economic contraction. And that's essentially what I'm saying in the book, that GDP growth, as we've known it over the past several decades and as we've come to expect, is just not in the cards for us anymore.
We're getting more and more obviously global, and because of that, we're outsourcing, and we know the story. We don't have to belabor it. But I think the real problem here is that there's a mindset somewhere in government, and I am not a conspiracy theorist. I'm not. I'm a pragmatist more than anything else. But if you take a look at what's going on, tax the rich. What do you do when you tax the rich? You tax the rich, you take money away from them, you take incentive away to put back into business and investment and growth. And that, i.e., in the end result, Richard, it means jobs. So I'm watching something going on here that I have never seen before, and I've been around this planet a good few years now. And I'm watching the decline. Everything you're saying is there, but it almost looks like it's intentional.
Well, I don't think it's intentional. I think everybody wants more economic growth. Both sides of the political spectrum are counting on it. And every politician wants to promise it. The problem is we live on a finite planet. And economic growth ultimately depends on natural resources, and especially energy. Without energy, we just can't do anything. You know, if the oil pumps run dry, or if the electricity is off, the whole economy just basically stops. And what we're looking at right now is a situation where global energy supplies are not growing, and that especially relates to oil. And the U.S., as a major oil importing country, as well the world's foremost oil importing country, is at the short end of the stick. We've seen global oil supplies to market stagnant since 2005, and that's with very high oil prices, record oil prices for much of that time. So it's not a question of running out of oil. We've just harvested the low-hanging fruit, and what's left is going to be more costly, it's going to be slower to produce, and it's going to produce worse environmental impacts as time goes on. That means no more economic growth.
Richard, no question about it, because when we think about it, that let's go back some years back. Let's go to NAFTA. Let's go to GATT, the North American Free Trade Organization. We put it all into Mexico, and someone found out that you could do it cheaper in China, et cetera, et cetera. So we moved it out of Mexico. Mexico needed jobs, and then they came across the border here, and on and on and on. I think the concern that I would have more than anything else that I have seen is that as much as this country needs money pumped into it to be able to produce, to get the GDP up, we're complaining about what we don't have, we're giving billions of dollars away to different countries, different organizations, different projects. And it seems as though that we're on the short end of the stick, and the money that we do get borrowed in the first place gets sent someplace else.
Right. Well, what happened back in the 1970s is very instructive in all of this. We got to a point where U.S. wages, hourly wages, reached their all-time peak and started to decline. And that's also the time that we started outsourcing jobs to, as you say, first to Mexico and then to China. So instead of burning the energy here and doing the manufacturing and so on, we were outsourcing both the pollution and the energy consumption. So now China is the world's foremost energy user. China's using 3.5 times as coal as we use in the United States, and they're using that energy to manufacture the stuff that we buy. Now, this sort of works as long as the U.S. is able to rack up more debt. I'm not talking just about government debt, but I'm talking about consumer debt. And it also works as long as we have the cheap energy with which to transport goods and materials, finished products, for very long distances. But neither of those conditions applies anymore. U.S. consumer debt can't grow anymore because household wealth is declining, because people's houses are only worth about 60% of what they were 3 years ago. Americans are loaned up to their eyeballs. Consumer debt can't grow anymore. And meanwhile, the cost of transport is increasing. That means globalization is going to go into reverse, maybe not tomorrow, but over the next 10, 20 years, we're going to see the need for more local manufacturing and a lot of economic trends, actually, that we've seen over the past half century are going to change in reverse.
Richard, when you look at local manufacturing, you've got to have dollars that are poured into that in the first place. And I think one of the biggest problems that we had when we started to go global was that we couldn't compete on a global marketplace. You know, you take Social Security, FICA, the rest of it out of somebody's wages, the employer still has to come up with that money, which effectively caused a problem in the competitive nature of whatever the product was. So I would look at this, that I don't want to sound like gloom and doom. I don't see any way out of this the way we're going. And if more people are out of work, we're going to cause some quote unquote riots in the street. You start to see it happening now. You see a tremendous amount of division between the ethnicities, between the genders, between the upper and the lower class. And I mean, this stuff goes on and on and on. And I wish I could see an end to it.
Well, Michael, I think you're absolutely right. There is no way out of this the way we're going. And that's really why I wrote the book. It's not that there's nothing we can do. There are lots of things we can and should be doing, and I discuss those in the last couple of chapters of the book. But the problem is that we have created a financial system and a monetary system, not only in this country but around the world, that only function under conditions of continual economic growth. And the reality is we live on a finite planet where nothing grows forever, including, you know, American waistlines. All of the trends we've been seeing over the past 20, 50 years, economists like to just extrapolate those trends into the future as though there are no limits. But in fact, there are limits. And that's what happens when history reaches fundamental turning points. And I think we're at one of those fundamental turning points right now. Actually, we have been since 2008. We're kind of like Wile E. Coyote, you know, in the old cartoons where he's chasing after the Roadrunner, and And Wile E. Coyote races off the edge of the cliff, and he hasn't quite realized that there's no cliff there supporting him, and he looks down, and, you know, it takes a couple of seconds before he actually starts falling. Well, I think we're in that situation here in the U.S. Those couple of seconds are lasting about 5 years, actually, from the initial puncturing of the balloon, the debt bubble, in 2007 until today. We're almost to 2012, and I think 2012 is going to be the key year in all of this.
Now, by the way, one of the things that I have looked at, and I am not excited about the current administration, but that said, it didn't happen in the last few years. Everything
right.
you've talked about, it's been coming. So obviously, there's a political message somewhere that we are missing, or the politics of the day are missing what we are saying here, quote unquote. They can't have a blind eye to this or a deaf ear. Obviously, the writing's on the wall, and they don't seem to do anything about it. That in and of itself, Richard, that's the scariest thing that we have to face. You've got people there that are supposed to be professionals, supposed to be watching out for us, and at the same time, you see what's going on.
Right. Well, the politicians are trying to give us what they think we want, which, of course, once again, is more economic growth. What we need to be doing is transitioning to a steady state economy, or one that actually can function with some contraction. Because I think what we're really looking at here is not just end of growth, but a long period of economic growth. Contraction. That sounds very scary, but, you know, we've been through hard times before. We've been through a Great Depression. We've been through two world wars. I think what we have facing us right now is probably at least on the scale of those previous experiences. But the point is, people survived. And how did they survive? Well, they hunkered down. They worked together. They got to know their neighbors. They grew garden veggies in the backyard. They scaled down their expectations rather than going into debt. They saved more. And those are exactly the things we should be doing now. The problem, of course, is that none of those things make the GDP grow. In fact, they do exactly the opposite. The sensible thing for people to do right now, which is to hunker down, not go into any more debt, pay off your debt, stop consuming as much, be more careful about what you're doing, all of those things cause the economy to contract. So we have an economy that incentivizes people doing stupid things. And our politicians, you know, are just cheerleaders for that system that really none of them created. This system we inherited from decades ago when we had cheap energy and the whole idea was for us to grow by stoking more consumer demand.
One of the major issues that we face today, I think even political at this stage of the game, is that there are certain people who forget who's working for who. And I think that's what we're really dealing with. I have been interviewing politicians for many, many years now, almost three decades, and I have watched the transition, the different mindsets, the different thinking. They come in fresh and clean, like what happened last November, but there's a euphoria. There's a something that catches up to them, and then their focus is on something completely different than it was when they started out. And it's not so much, and if you watch what's going on in Congress today, in the Senate, what you're seeing is not what's good for you and I, but a battle of who's right and who's wrong and who's going to win and who's going to lose. And they're looking for that next vote. That, in and of itself, is going to hurt us.
Right, and politics have become more polarized. That's not helping the situation. And another thing that's making matters difficult is that, over the past 30, 40 years, when it became more and more difficult to grow the economy with manufacturing, we began growing by financialization. And Wall Street has grown to enormous, not only size in terms of the amount of money that's being invested and wagered and bet, but also in terms of its political influence. So over the last 3 or 4 years, as we've been in this financial crisis, what's happened? Well, we have taken debt, bad debts, basically bad bets, on the part of the big investment banks, Wall Street banks, and we have transferred those to the public sector. And that's the main reason why now we're seeing this debt crisis in Washington. Both the Federal Reserve and the U.S. Treasury have taken over a lot of toxic assets that were in the bank vaults. And Wall Street is still calling the shots. So rather than politicians in Washington debating about how to reform Wall Street and make Wall Street pay, we're talking about how to make the American people pay for generation after generation in the future. Well, this works up to a point, but as the pie begins to shrink, we're going to be facing, as you said, riots in the street as people realize that the benefits that they've come to expect are no longer going to be there for them.
No question. Richard, we're just about out of time. Is there a website that we can find you at and buy the book? Because your message is spot on and more people should hear it. Where do we find you?
Yeah, thank you. Well, best thing is for people to go to richardheinberg.com. So that's Richard, H-E-I-N-B-E-R-G.com. And they'll be able to find out more about the book there. And we have YouTube videos, we have free downloads, and I work with an organization called Post Carbon Institute, and our organization puts out a lot of very useful reports on both economics and on world resources and energy.
Great. Hey, Richard, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Well, thank you, Michael. Appreciate it.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there, when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. Think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. In 1982, Mellon Thomas died of terminal brain cancers. Mellon Thomas Benedict and survived to tell about it. While in the hospice of care, Mellon died or was without vital signs for at least an hour and a half before he returned to his body. Mellon Thomas is one of the most studied near-deathers in the world. He's taken a part in more research and think tanks than any other near-deather. And since his near-death experience, Mellon Thomas has devoted himself to scientific projects. Mellon Thomas, welcome to the show.
Hi, it's great to be on the air with you.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. When we talk about near-death experience, so many people have talked about it. There's so many stories about what happens, but you were there. You've been there. You've done that. Let's take you all the way back to when this happened. Was there an out-of-body experience? What did you actually experience during that hour and a half before they brought you back?
Well, you know, I was completely clueless when this happened to me. This is way back before that subject was as popular as it is today. So I had been diagnosed with terminal brain cancer, given 6 to 8 months to live. And it was inoperable and incurable at the time. And I was thick as a brick in those days. And I'd never heard of the word near-death till after my near-death experience. I'd never heard of the word hospice till I ended up in one. So was not well prepared at all. But I to my great amazement, what I did learn, I did succumb to my disease. And for whatever reason, I was given a second chance. And to my amazement, I really discovered what many near-deathers see and believe, and that is this whole subject of death is an illusion, that we are a continuous life form, and that life itself is endless. And I experienced that. I died and lived to tell about it.
But when we talk about, Mel, when we talk about dying, you know, obviously there's a physical death that occurs. And time and again, there have been cases that someone has passed away, someone's died, and they've measured the body before and after, and there's just that little bit of difference in the weight. So people who have been there during the death experience actually watch something leaving the body, quote unquote. Now, that happens, and I'm a very strong believer that when you die, it can't be just over with. There's got to be something more to this soul that we have and this process that allows us to experience whatever it is that we do here. But when you do die, they talk about light. They talk about understanding. What's it feel like? Is it just an experience of knowing?
Well, I can tell you this. What's interesting is that I devoted my life to science and research after my near-death experience, and I can tell you exactly what they're talking about. Since my near-death experience, science has discovered something called biophotons, and this is exactly what every living thing lives off of, and it's light. Biophotons are light. Now, when I had my near-death experience, I literally woke up and found myself outside of my body looking at my body, and I saw this light leaving my body. I didn't know what it was at the time, but, you know, photons are actual physical substance. They have weight, they have volume, and what we know now, and science has bared this out beautifully, is that as the body dies and as the cells release their energy, they release these biophotons. This can actually be photographed and it can actually be weighed. So there was something to what all these people were saying after all. This light that we're made of, you know, it's interesting that in all philosophies on Earth, we seem to come from the light. We're all about light while we live, and we return to the light. It's this cycle that we continuously repeat and expand on.
When we get here, and obviously we grow, and based on the culture that we're in, we make certain determinations. We create certain behaviors. And those behaviors dictate what our life is like, and there's where all of the judgments and everything else are. Now, I know it's very hard to say to somebody that don't judge anything, and that's, yeah, sure, right. But at the same time, if you get beyond the body, there's nothing to judge. If the body's not there, you can't see if something's pretty or ugly. You don't have the judgment. Are they good? Are they bad? They just are. And I think that in and of itself has got to be the hardest concept for anybody to grasp.
Well, you know, judgment's one thing, but the higher form of it is called when you are discerning. We have to be discerning to know what is hot and what is cold. We have to be discerning to know if this is a bad guy or a good guy. This is all very important stuff to know. Judgment is more on the ego level. When you judge someone for the way they look, or they don't have money, or they have too much money, all that is an ego type of judgment. But I can tell you this, when you do return to that light, you will not be judged for anything you think about, in any manner you think you should be judged. The interesting thing is that the life review that near-deathers report, that they get this life, most of them get this, you can skip your life review, but most of them get this life review. And I can tell you from personal first-hand experience that this life review, the review of your life at the end of your life, is the biggest judgment you will ever go through. It's self-judgment. And isn't that the hardest, usually the most tough judgment on earth, is the self-judgment? And you get to see your actions, good and not so good. You get to see how they affected others and your own life. You get to see sort of a holographic view of the decisions and things you did or didn't do in your life, and you judge yourself. Once you get to that light, you are not judged at all. There is no judgment at that light. And that's what a lot of religions and things don't ever want you to believe or know about, because they use that that whole thing about you're going to be judged for all of this at the end of the day by a God in the sky as a way to control you in many ways. It's beyond, it's bigger than all that. It's much bigger. And this life review not only helps you to self-correct, and it may take you many lifetimes to self-correct, it not only helps you self-correct, but that life review is part of the light experience of which all of us are experiencing at the same time. This is one of the most amazing things that I learned, that there's only one of us here. That may seem like a philosophical axiom, but it's not. Every human being on earth came from the same place. And in every human being, there is every form of life that's ever been on this planet living within us. So it's like the first astronauts saw when they got to the moon and they photographed the Earth. All they saw was one living being, planet Earth. They didn't see countries, they didn't see borders, they didn't see religions, they didn't see skin colors. And we're just now, in our evolution, coming to that point where we can begin to understand there's only one of us here. And so that whole that wisdom that came over 2,500 years ago, wisdom like do unto others as you would have them do unto yourself, is really, really incredible stuff to understand.
Let me hold you up for a minute, because I think it's a couple of things are extremely important. The first thing is that when you do die, you know, you mentioned good and bad early on. If you do die, is there really any good and bad? Is it, do you get to that neutral space where it doesn't exist? You know, we've created heaven and hell and the rest of it here. But if you don't have a body and you don't have anything to lose, and you don't, and you don't have anything to quote unquote gain except the essence of being, how could there be good and bad?
Well, I've often said this to people, and it may shock them, that honestly, the other side is not all it's cracked up to be. And the other side is just as interactive as this side of life. And on this side of life, we have every shade of activity and energy, from the darkest dark to the lightest light. The same exists on the other side. There are hell regions, but these are regions of thought forms, and these are regions of you know, desperate desires. That does exist on the other side. The other side is not all nice and sweet. It's very reflective of what we live here, and it's just as interactive. And so, yes, what we do think, the very thoughts that we die with, the very thoughts at the moment of our death, the very desires, the very fears at the moment of our death are carried with us. And there is that moment when you're with the light where you feel ecstatic. I know what that feeling is. You're with the light. But that feeling basically comes from dropping your heavy gravity body. And let me tell you, that feeling of being with the light is the same feeling as if you've won the biggest lottery on planet Earth, and you'll never have to worry about rent again. You'll never have any of those survival worries again. And that is a euphoric experience. But there's more to it than that. There's more than just going to the light. And that's what my story has been about all these many years later, is telling people that there's a lot more to this than just the simple story of going to the light, I saw God, and everything was happy. There's a lot more to it than that.
Well, Melon, we got about 3 or 4 minutes to go, and I want to make sure I've got something a point out before we do. Two things, and then let me give you both of them, then respond to each one. The first one, what I'm hearing you say is, based on those thoughts that you have as an individual here on Earth, that's going to mold and shape what's going to happen to you after you lose the body and you go from there. Now, the second thing, which I think is interesting, the biophoto light. You've replicated that in the dream spa, haven't you?
Yes, I was given the gift of invention in my near-death experience, and I've invented many technologies, and especially I'm focused on technologies that help heal and rejuvenate people.
So when
and
you
the
talk,
dream, the dream spa is my latest. I've designed many many very very expensive systems for many corporations in the past and
yeah.
medical applications. But the dream spa is really the one I've always wanted to get out, that everyone can have one of these in their home.
Okay, so we're talking about phototherapy, and we are talking about the technology. And stop me if I'm wrong here, because I'm just. I'm working off of what you're saying here. That from what I'm seeing here is the dream spa. You can actually experience that same kind of an experience as an after death. Because if we are composed of the biophoto light, and you put me in something that I can experience that same kind of light, would I not have the experience of what it's like not to have a body?
Many people say that when they use the system. It's not unusual for people to report that. It's a wonderful feeling, and also it's a perfect energy that we actually live on. We actually live on light. We don't live on food.
Yeah, and I got that loud and clear, because when you break it all down, the food breaks, then the chemicals break into light, and it goes from there. We're just about out of time. Melon, let me ask you this. Is there a website we can find you at and find out more about the Dream Spa and some of the other technologies that you've developed?
Yes, the Dream Spa can be found at the website lighthealthresearch.com, and you can read all about it there. Also, I'm going to be at a conference with Dr. Bernie Siegel in Norwalk, Connecticut on August 26th, 27th, 28th at the Dulles Hotel and Resort. And people can check that out on, and you can go to www.soulwisdom.org. And I'm actually going to be showing these technologies. I'll actually be doing a whole seminar on the deepest lessons I learned when I was with the light.
Wonderful. Hey, Melon Thomas Benedict, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been great. Thanks a lot, Ray. Michael Ray.
Take care. Good night.
You too. Bye.
You may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me, you know, yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. Yeah, I'm gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so quick, you're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days. My hugging, you're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, lover, you always had your way. If you need me, you know it's gonna grieve me. You'll miss your brown-eyed daddy. Grab it now, some of these days.
Well, Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Do whatever the hell you want. Why the world needs more selfish women. Christine Sales with us. She's an internet blogger, and she's the author of the new book, The Most Selfish Women in America, How to Make Your Divorce the Best Thing That Ever Happened to You. And the question is, what does it really mean to be selfish? Is it always a horrible thing? What if more women decided to take care of their own needs first and put the needs of the others second? What would happen? And let's ask her. Christina, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. How is it? How are you today?
I'm doing fine. What's it like? Now, by the way, selfish can be a really good word, because if you don't take care of yourself, for the most part, nobody else is going to.
Well, that is so true. But think about the word selfish as self first.
Yeah.
Put yourself first and stop being at the last of the line. It's enough with putting yourself last all the time. Enough with being so exhausted that you can't even think straight. Enough of your being bored, not to mention boring.
Now, by the way, no question about it. And I think it goes back to that old adage that if you're on a plane and there's a problem and you've got a baby in your arms and the oxygen mask drops, do you put it on you or do you put it on the baby? You put it on yourself, because that baby can't survive without you.
How funny are you? That's exactly one of the scenarios I use. You're on an airplane, oxygen mask drops from the ceiling. You put it on yourself first before you help others in need, because you are going to be completely worthless if you keel over first.
No, absolutely. Now, one of the things you talk about, this is not just a mindset. There's a process behind it. Natural foods, exercise, affirmations, and all of those things together. I don't think anybody could wake up one morning and say, okay, I'm selfish. I'm going to take care of me, and I'm going to handle the world. Because there's got to be a process behind it. There's certain things you have to do to get yourself ready for something like that and build a foundation. So if you do get knocked on your rear end, you're able to get up and keep moving forward.
Absolutely. And let me just say this. This is a call out to all of the unhappy women in America, because it is time to get happy. And I am giving you permission to become the leading lady in your own life. I am giving you permission to become a selfish woman. If you start taking care of your needs first, every other aspect of your life will be enhanced. There won't be a need for guilt, feeling unfulfilled, neglected, or even exhausted. You'll be more vibrant. You'll have more energy. You'll look better, feel better, be better. But there is a mindset that goes with this. And the biggest component is taking care of yourself physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually. And they all play a part in your overall transition to being the best you could have ever been.
You know, by the way, when we talk about that life goes by very quickly, I'll say it in that way, it truly does. I got an email today, and a friend of mine that I haven't seen for many years passed away this morning. And I blink my eyes, and I see us as kids. And I remember him as a kid. I remember him when he was 14, 15, 16 years old. And it was just – but if you think about it, with a blink of an eye, you were 12 years old. And all of a sudden, you're as old as you are now. And where did it all go? And if you're not very careful, it's going to be gone, and you're not going to have any advantage of what you can make out of life.
Well, that is so true. And you have to remember, you dictate the way your life turns out. Bad things happen to everybody. Bad things happen to good people. But it's how you choose to respond to that shows your true character. Whether you have lost a person due to death, due to divorce, if you've had a serious illness, if you've come to a midlife crisis, quarter-life crisis even, the same philosophy applies. It's the same way of reinventing where you are now and making this new phase of your life your best phase yet. And that's something about the word selfish. This word selfish is an acronym for all the different aspects of your life that need to be reassessed, reinvented, and redirected for a positive reinvention, whether it be after divorce or really after any other traumatic event in your life. Because every life has phases, And with every phase of life comes change. So becoming a selfish woman can make you make that next phase your best phase ever.
Now, okay, big question. Where was it for you that you woke up? The light bulb came on and you realized what life could be like. There had to be something in your life that really caused you to think about this and turn it around.
Well, actually, my story is I was unhappily married to the wrong man for 17 years. But like probably a lot of your listeners out there, I was raised to believe you did whatever it took to keep the marriage together as long as there were children involved. So after years of trying and trying and working at it, because we know it takes two, right? I woke up one day and I just went, to hell with this. I do not deserve to be this unhappy. Life is too short. I am done. And it was the hardest decision I ever made, but it was the best decision I ever made.
Well, sure. Look at the lifestyle change for you. You know, and most people are frightened to death of making any kind of a change because they don't know what the future has to hold. They're not sure what's going to go on tomorrow. And sometimes you just got to bite the bullet and take the wool by the horns and just move through and get it done.
Which is why I think a book like this is so important. Yes, granted, I wrote it for newly divorced women, but when you suffer such a loss, even just the mourning of the dream of a happy marriage, sometimes you get so entrenched in the sadness that you need a light. You need someone to turn a beacon on and show you the way out of the darkness and into the light. And that's what this book is. It's a guide for positive reinvention. And it'll be things, you'll read things that you think, oh, this is so obvious. But you don't think about it in your deepest times of despair.
Now, how do you deal with somebody that, you're right, somebody's in their deepest time of despair, and you walk in and you say, you can be the most powerful woman in the world. How do you get them to believe that? And that's a fair question.
It is a fair question. And I think it just takes some real soul searching and seeing someone who has been where you are and who has risen above. And if you just see that you do not have to be that miserable, who wants to be that miserable? Nobody. So their goal is to get out of that misery as soon as possible. And if someone were to throw me a lifeline, I would have grabbed onto it immediately.
Now, by the way, do you do workshops, seminars? What do you do with this information?
Well, right now it's just in book form. It's my job to get this message out. There's no reason for women to be any more miserable than they have to be. But, yes, it will be turning into workshops, life coaching seminars, life coaching sessions, private sessions for people who really need it, because I think it's time.
Yeah, now, by the way, I think a great thing, did you send your ex-husband the book?
No, but, you know, that's kind of the play on the title. There were so many times when I've been accused of being selfish and doing everything for myself and not for my children. And, I mean, I was a stay-at-home mom. That was the farthest thing from the truth. But in coming up with the title of the book, it was kind of, I guess, my last laugh. And then for me to turn that lemon, those sour lemons into lemonade, I thought, selfish being an acronym for what? A positive reinvention? I couldn't have thought of a better title.
Yeah, see, I don't see selfish as an adult now, looking at selfish from many different aspects. See, I don't see it as taking advantage of other people. What I see it as is, if you're not the best you can be, how are you going to give that to someone else? If you're deluded in who you are, what you're going to give to someone else is a delusion. So if you're everything that you want to be about yourself, then that's what you can give. And who you'll run into is somebody that can deal with it and accept it.
And see, what you have to realize is, it goes for people in general, but especially for women, we have an exponential effect on everyone we come in contact with. The sooner you embrace that realization, the sooner you can make a positive effect on this world. And isn't that what we're trying to do? Lead and teach by example? How can we do that if we are not totally embracing the life. Being positive, sharing that with others, and that in turn and that exponentially goes out into the world, taking light instead of darkness.
But by the way, Christy, you are teaching. When you aren't being selfish, when you are being turned into whatever, you are setting a model for your kids, because if they see you doing it, that's what they think is the way. That's what they think is the way to be. So any way you look at it, you're teaching. So you might as well choose what you're teaching.
Absolutely, and you have to remember that leading by example even goes to the bagger at the grocery store. The smile, the attitude, the choosing to perpetuate the positive and not the negative. And that's one of the things that I discourage. Don't get involved in vengeance. Don't get involved in the negativity. Don't be paralyzed by the chaos of change. Be it, see it, be it, live it. Be the person you want to be. Share that with other people and make this world better than it was when you got here.
And then everybody gets to be that way. It's going to be very interesting that for you to meet a man who thinks exactly like you do. I don't think I'd want to be in the same room.
I don't know. I think it would be great.
Oh, sure. No, absolutely. I'm playing with you when it comes to that. But if you do become everything that you can possibly be, then that spreads. And that's what you give people. And that, effectively, is what you get back. And if you want to make life hell, life will be hell.
Absolutely. And you dictate your outcome. You can either choose to be happy or you can choose to be sad. Happiness is a choice. It is not a result of circumstances.
No. And now, by the way, how long were you married?
17 years.
Okay, so it took you 17 years to actually see what was going on. How did he deal with when you said, I'm done, it's enough?
He didn't believe me. He didn't believe me because he knew I had just kept trying, and I was bound to keep trying. And really, I was becoming a facilitator. And that, there's nothing positive about that. My children were old enough that they understood and even questioned why I was still in the relationship. And, you know, it was time for me to release myself, release the guilt, release the obligation, and think about my future. Is this how I want to spend the second half of my life? I don't think so.
Okay, so you became this absolutely brand new person. How'd the kids deal with it?
Honestly, I think they're proud because it's a night and day situation. I didn't like who I was before, what I was becoming by having to be involved with such a negative, cynical person. And when I was able to release the last tether of that old life, I just blossomed. I bloomed. I turned into the type of person that they seek to be around. And I'm talking teenagers and young adults.
Yeah. Okay, but let me ask you a question. They saw it, they felt it, they experienced it. What if they were younger? Well, you know, a 10, 11-year-old or 8 or 9-year-old who doesn't have a tremendous amount of understanding about the way the world works and relationships and so on and so forth. How do you work? And this is a question. I mean, it's just an honest, nothing behind it question. How do you deal with that? There's a lot of women who have 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10-year-olds. And those kids don't quite get it. How do you go through the transition and at the same time keep that communication going, the relationship, the bonding with the kids?
Well, honestly, you can only do it from your end, and it has to include a lot of love, a lot of patience, no judgment, complete acceptance, unconditional love. And you're just going to have to continue to reinforce that you are better out of that situation than you were in it. And if it's bad enough that it ends in divorce, it's obvious to the kids that it's bad. It's not good for anybody. Everybody's unhappy. You can't hide that.
Other women who have read the book, what kind of feedback are you getting?
Well, I've gotten some pretty good reviews. Now, granted, it's only been out since April, but I've heard that it's a great roadmap for bringing you out of the cloud of misery and into the brightness of your new life. I've honestly been tooting my own horn, but I've just had lots of compliments. People say it's a great guidebook. A girlfriend just read it on the airplane coming back, recently divorced. She said it was the best thing she could have read at that time in her life. And what more can you ask for?
Nothing. No, absolutely.
Because it covers so many aspects of your life that you neglect. You think I'm going to take care of A, B, and C, but that D through F can be just as debilitating if not addressed.
No question. And I think a lot of it, too, you know, the key words are the roadmap, you know, that blueprint, the pathway to get somewhere. Most people want something different in their life. But they can't, they don't know what it is. And more important, when they do find out what it is, the next question is, how do you get there? And that's really what the key. Most people need to be held by the hand, somebody looking over their shoulder, seeing what they don't see, bringing that quote-unquote invisible up to the table, and move forward. The two things that go on in people's minds. The first one is, are there answers? And the second one is, they're frightened to death of being alone in a decision. And when you get somebody like yourself who puts the book out and does what you do, when they begin to relate and understand that other people have had the same thoughts that they've had, then all of a sudden, quote unquote, they're not alone, and they get to realize that there are answers out there.
Well, and you think of how much easier it is to get from point A to point B if you have a guidebook, if you have a roadmap. And why try to reinvent the wheel at such a pivotal time in your life when you can access a book like The Most Selfish Woman in America and read it? It's a very quick read. Not a lot of unnecessary words. It is to the point. It is a fast read, and it's that way on purpose. You can take it, go on with your day. Take another piece the next day, go on with your day. Or you can sit and read it in a couple of hours. But it is a guide for people who need it the most.
I hear you loud and clear. Christy, a website we can find you at?
TheMostSelfishWomanInAmerica.com. And I am giving you permission to become a selfish woman. Go to TheMostSelfishWomanInAmerica.com. Buy your copy. Read the blog. I'll personalize the copy if you say you heard it on this radio station and the Dresser After Dark. And learn how to make your dream life a reality, because becoming a selfish woman will make this new phase of your life the best phase yet.
I'll give you some advice my grandmother used to give us all the time. She would say before we'd leave, she'd say, go out and kick some posterior.
Okay. I would have liked her.
Christy, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much.
Good night.
Good night, Mike.
There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you'll adore. Yeah, it's me that you'll adore. That's all.
Every night I hope and pray a dream lover will come my way.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Jenny Clark coming up next.
A chance because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. Dream lover, where are you?
Jenny Clark with us. She's the co-author of Career Mapping, Charting Your Course in the New World of Work. And it is a new world out there. She's the founder of Talent Optimization Partners, LLC, which provides corporate consulting, executive coaching services. She's a sought-after speaker, and she spent 12 years at Spencer Stuart, one of the world's largest senior-level executive search firms, and is a partner and the leader of the Global Diversity Practice. And let us say, Jenny, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, when we are dealing with career mapping, I think the title in and of itself truly says it, because I think everything in life, from what I've seen over all these years, that it's a process, and you have to have step one, two, three, four, five, and whatever the components are, because if you don't have it and you don't follow the map, quote unquote, you're not going to get anywhere.
You just won't. It's a proven fact.
Now, what got you into this place?
I'm sorry?
Oh, I said, what got you into career mapping in the first place?
Well, my own experience is that I wanted to be a veterinarian coming out of high school and going into college, and I graduated instead with a degree in French and linguistics, and then I became a college recruiter. I went to business school. I went into banking, commercial real estate for 10 years, and then executive search for 12, and left a couple of years ago to start my own firm. So part of that whole experience for me, it wasn't that I was flighty or indecisive, I just couldn't find that one platform that suited me for the rest of my life. And so I took chances and created this process, particularly by virtue of being an executive recruiter, to help people think through all those different phases of their lives.
Now, by the way, when you're dealing with the job market today and whatever profession, look at all the variables that we have in today's world with the economy, et cetera, that we didn't have 4 or 5 years ago. If I'm going to apply for a job, it could be a professional job or a lay job, whatever it is. It used to be to have 4 or 5 people applying for the job. You got, 5,000 people out there applying for the same thing right now. And unless you have that backup, the dynamic of how to do it, you're going to be in trouble.
Yeah, you are going to be in trouble. And, one of the things I tell people is, too, that don't just look for those open positions. My whole mapping process is really trying to allow people to have sort of a free agency mindset and give them the tools that they need to not only stand out for the jobs that they're applying for, but more importantly, to learn how to maneuver and network their way into opportunities for jobs that might not even be posted. And there are millions of them out there.
When we talk about those jobs, by the way, I think that's the key. The ones that you don't know are posted. Oh, it must
have been
150 years ago. I went to work, and I was in Norris Thermador Corporation in Southern California, and I spent 8-9 hours a day. There would be these iron wheels, like car wheels, coming down a conveyor, and I would take them off the conveyor and I put them on a rack, and they would just go on. And I'll tell you what, I was in great shape, but I wasn't really going anywhere. Plus, it was the midnight shift, and I was like 19, 20 years old at the time, no social life. So I walked in, I walked into the employment area of it, and I said, "Can I get on days?" And they laughed at me. And I started to walk out, and I put my hand on the door. And I turned around and walked back to the guy sitting behind the desk. I said, I got half a brain here, and if you let me use it, I can benefit this company. And he looked at me and he said, "You ever had any chemical experiences?" He said, "Oh, yeah." So I walked out. They needed somebody in the chem lab. And one thing, by the way, in high school, I got a D in Chem 1. But I walked out, I found out, and when I got interviewed, whatever I said was the right thing, and I spent 3.5 years, as a chemical analyst there. But the key is, you just said it, you never know what's there that you weren't even aware of.
That's right. My dad said something to me, and he was a prison warden in Southern California, no less. And he said years ago, "Jenny, tell people what you want." So telling people what you want, coupled by knowing what it is that you have to offer, is the magical combination, and that requires that you have made some decisions for yourself that no one else can make for you, and you've made some choices. It doesn't have to be forever, but make a choice now, put a stake in the ground, and let people know what you're committed to doing.
Yeah, Susie Greenman, Radio Susie, her daughter has got she's a, what is she? What is she, Susie? Okay, she's training to be a pastry chef, and the kid is good. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And she wrote a resume to whoever it was, and I looked at the resume, and she said, I do this, I do this, and I do that. And I added a sentence on the back of it, and I added, and I love what I do. Just
right.
That in itself is just a little bit different that they're going to look at.
Well, and let's hope you mean it. I mean, I think so many people are in a mindset that says, I'm going to just go do this just to make some money. And I'm saying, figure out what it is that you're going to be passionate about, because you're going to be that much more compelling to a prospective employer if you can really convey your passion. And I don't care what it is. I have a girlfriend who's a pastry chef, too. And she ended up that wasn't paying her enough, so she ended up doing some other things, and she's figuring out how to become an event planner. And so she's leveraging her knowledge of food and pastries and all these other things to create an opportunity in yet a different way. And so part of what my mapping process is talking about is sort of extracting all those elements, I call them competencies, that might exist in these roles that you want to just label and say, well, I can do this. Well, break it apart into bite-sized pieces and then figure out how you can apply those pieces into different kinds of situations. And if you can do that and convince somebody, just as you did, you said, well, I've had a little chemical experience, might not have been a lot, but you knew a few things. And you were able to parlay that into something that could really take you somewhere.
Oh, I went from, and those, I have to, I'll tell you what I made an hour, but you get ready for this, I'm going to impress you. I went from $1.60 to $2.10 an hour.
Ooh, that's a big jump though.
It was major money in those days. But the point was, it's called listening, and that's all you have to do. There are too many people who walk in and they have no idea what they're going to do or what they're going to say, and I truly believe that if you prep for it in the first place, you know what you're going to do before you go in, you know what you want. And one of the things I found out over the years is that an interview like that is a two-way street. You have to do your interview with them, too, to make sure you like what you're getting.
You absolutely do. Don't let it be a one-way street. You need to be discerning, because you might walk out of there thinking, there's no way I want to work here. And that's valid. Because we're trying to minimize any reasons for departure or for there not being a fit. And all employers are not created equal. So be discerning. And at one point I thought about naming my book, You Choose, because I feel as though so many people wait to be chosen, and they're very passive. And I'm saying, no, 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 you stand up and you decide which employers are worthy of you once you've decided what skills you're ready to offer them.
Oh, sure. And by the way, from what you're saying also, it's not just for the newbie going out into the job market, quote unquote. What about this person ready to retire and wants to switch into something completely different? The rules of the game are all the same.
They are exactly the same. I'm glad you said that. In fact, in the book, I really, at the end of every chapter, have a call out for five different levels of people. So it's entry level, mid level, executive, encore, which is over 55, and what I call detour. Those are folks that might have been out of the workforce for a while. So I'm really trying to help people understand that, no, it's not just when you're looking for a job or thinking about making a big transition. It's when you're in the job. And how do you set yourself up to be successful in that job and to even get promoted into a bigger job?
Oh, and by the way, just to make sure that $1.62-something an hour, that's between you and I.
I promise I won't tell a soul.
We don't tell anybody about that. but when you really come down to it, you've got to have something different about yourself if you're going to apply. They're sitting back and they're listening, they're watching, and you're right. You really have to want what that position is, and also look for those opportunities of something that you didn't even know existed that could be there. And there could be a job that somebody goes after that wouldn't have been the right fit. But that certain something, if you presented yourself in the right way, they're back there thinking, oh, I wonder if this person would work this way, and you could find a career of a lifetime that you didn't even know was there.
Happens every day, at all levels, by all means. And that's why I'm saying it's incumbent upon you, the individual, to articulate what those portable skills are that you can bring. Even if you don't have experience in something, you can make a case for doing it based on those competencies, those pieces that you can bring to it. And that's something that I tell employers, too. Stop looking for people to just have experience doing what you need done. And that might sound a little counterintuitive, but think about it. Did you know how to ride a bike before you rode one? I mean, so, but your legs moved, right?
Sure. So no, absolutely.
You've got to think
question
in terms of, you know, what are you prepared to do?
You know, there's something else that there's another factor to throw into the mix here. And I think it's very interesting. I have watched people apply for jobs, you know, and in today's world, I go back to a world when you got in a plane, you got dressed up, you wore a sport jacket, a suit or something. That's not what you do today, as an example.
Right.
And I have watched kids go into workplaces to apply for a job looking horrible. And they can't understand why they didn't get the job. There are certain rules that still apply. The world is different. Jenny, there's no question. It is. But
right.
But
there are certain protocols, and it's a matter of respect. The workplace has become more casual, yes, but come on, no flip-flops for an interview. Wear a button-down shirt. It can be khakis, but wear a belt. You know, you're not going to the beach. You're going for a job. And you do want to impress people. You want to show that you have some discipline, you have some awareness about, you know, the workplace that they operate in. And what you might wear in California might be different from what you'd wear in New York. So be aware of those nuances as well.
No, absolutely. There's no question about that. And the ability to talk to someone there, and especially the kids today, for the most part. Now, there's some kids out there that are extremely bright and they're verbal and they sound good and they're mm-hmm. articulate. But there's a lot of them that you ask them a question and they say, and their eyes drop. And that happens also in interviews. And they just can't get that they can be any way they want to be because they're applying for a job. Someone is going to pay you to do something. So you're going to have to do some mental shifting and other shifting if you want the job.
Absolutely. There are a few things with that. You know, there are social skills and protocols that say that you look somebody in the eye when you're speaking to them. You know, my mother used to just insist that be the case. So, again, it's a matter of understanding what some of those social protocols are and respecting them in these kinds of situations. Those things are really important. And then being able to really articulate both verbally and in written form, you know, who you are and what you're about. And mind you, the written form is really concerning, too, because our kids are texting and they don't even know how to spell and put together a sentence.
Oh, no question. But that's something else that is very interesting. And that's changing also as far as the difference in the age groups and the styles of the way people communicate back and forth.
Yeah.
We're in a world right now that these brand new kids coming up, they have no idea what it was like without a cell phone, without a computer, without so on and
right.
so forth. And they speak differently and it's hard to communicate with them if you come from a different generation. That in and of itself has got to be tough when you've got the mix of the two, three generations. That's something an employer's got to get over. And also that kid that's in that generation has got to realize if they want what they want, they've got to step outside themselves. They don't have to change, but just for the interview. Don't be you, be what they want.
For the moment, yes. You're not totally assimilating. You're not caving in. You can still be you, but honor and respect the environment that you're in. And I go back to, I have a 15-year-old son, and he can act one way at home, but I insist that he act another way in public. And they're pretty consistent, I'll be honest with you. I have pretty high standards, but you know, I'm willing to let him walk around in his shorts and whatnot, but when we go out, I expect him to look decent if he's going to be seen with me. And I expect him to hold his head up and look people in the eye and shake their hands. And so, you know, I'm insisting that there be this level of respect. He's also studying Chinese, by the way, and I'm a big proponent of language skills, studying foreign languages as a way of understanding our own language and improving upon it in terms of vocabulary and diction and all these other things. So that's really critical.
No question about it. And in today's world, as high-tech as this world is today, you know, there were some, I think it was, I forgot what state it was, some of the high schools are going to get rid of learning how to write. They don't need it anymore. It takes too much time. They've got texting. They've got this. They've got that. So it's a completely different world out there, and the communication level is completely different also. And we're going global, whether we like it or not. That's exactly what's going on today. And those kids starting out, they've got to be able to step up to the plate and be able to deal. And if they've got the process to do it, they work out and they're on a level playing field. If not, they're going to be a lot of sad kids.
there are going to be a lot of sad kids, I'm afraid, because those kids that aren't going to get those writing skills are going to be, for all intents and purposes, illiterate, right? Yeah. Because they don't read except what's on a screen. So they're not reading classics. They're not understanding language. They're not building other capacities for storytelling and this whole conceptual mind that allows them to have better verbal skills. So they're getting left behind, and there are plenty of children from outside of this country who are getting trained in English and 3 and 4 and 10 other languages who are going to make for much better employees because of their facility with language, their ability to do critical thinking. There are a lot of implications to this that are pretty frightening.
Now, by the way, one of the things that I'm hearing you say is that because of what's going on in our educational system, when we do the career mapping, that's the bridge to get from one place to the other. That's the compensation for what they don't get in school to learn how to apply for a job and how to deal in a society or a culture where that you're going to get eaten up if you don't have the competitive skills to get where you want to go.
That's exactly right, and I would add that the mapping is also a way to, I spend a lot of time talking about gaps. Okay, so you figured out where you are where you are. Okay, we're going to accept that. Now, for younger people, you can start now by taking a look at this and putting forth some of the, getting the right education, all those things that are going to kind of fill in your maps, start to fill it in for you. But for those people that might be out of college already and you've got some gaps, let's identify them and figure out what it is that you can go back and get. If it's education, if it's technical skills, whatever those things might be, but you're doing it with a mind towards something that you selected as your aspirational role or 2 or 3 different roles or functions that you see yourself performing in. So you know where you're going and what it is that you need to fill up those gaps.
Jenny Clark, we're just about out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at and buy the book and get more information?
Absolutely. It's called mycareermapping.com, mycareermapping.com. And the book is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and my website. Oh, and iTunes.
Oh, wonderful. Hey, by the way, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me. Thoroughly enjoyed it.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
There's so many exciting and wonderful places. Mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is. So why stay there? There are so many fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome. come back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Ron Martin with us, and we're going to talk about why Obama will win in the 2012 election, regardless of how low his ratings are right now. Ron was born in Illinois in the autumn of 1943, in the middle of World War II, where he lived until 58. Then he moved to Florida, and he graduated from Pompano Beach High School in 1961, and he attended electronics classes in Miami in 62. Now, he was hired by a CIA contractor in October 62 to help build and operate a 100,000-watt transmitter in the Dry Tortugas during the Cuban crisis to disrupt Cuban and Russian communications, jam enemy air and sea transmissions, monitor submarines and surfacing ship movements, and act as a CNC for American forces in the Caribbean. And he's been given top secret clearance. Now, with that, he's got a tremendous background. And let's just say, Ron Martin, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Oh, and by the way, Ron, why do you think that Obama is going to get back in no matter what? And that's really what we're dealing with.
Well, to me, I study this about every day in as deep and as much information as I can. And to me, his reelection is one of the very few absolutes in life that we can count on. If election junkies would ignore the polls and the media and the talking heads and think out of the box, they would see it too. Nobody should get excited over the polls. Legitimate polls don't count dead, moved, non-existent, or unpurged voters. The voter rolls in all 50 states are rarely purged. People don't realize this just because it's so expensive. Their budgets are very small, so if you move five times in 3 years, you're probably in five different locations. They are purged very rarely. But Democrats count on this. They pick up 1 to 9% of their votes with the unpurged rolls, the dead people, the Daffy Ducks of the world. And this is one of the problems with our rolls. But we've had so many years to straighten out these problems, but we don't do it.
Now, Ron, when we take a look at it, I'm looking. You know what's going on today. I'm looking at the economy the way it is. I'm looking at all of the money that we need. They're going to take away Medicare. They're going to tap into Social Security. I mean, this list goes on and on and on. We're going to be affected with our military being cut down, police forces who can't pay their people, and this list just goes on and on. That's just touching the surface. In addition to that, when you take a look at it, we are giving away billions of dollars to countries all over the world for whatever reason, and it's coming back at us. Now, it hasn't happened like that since this man got into office. And if the American people don't see what's going on with this, then something's wrong and we deserve what we get.
Well, you know, Obama's second term will fundamentally transform what the first term didn't. His first term gave him the power to corrupt, and he's used it. But his second term gives him the absolute power to absolutely corrupt. And you've heard that, Lord. That's Lord Acton's original words. But nationalizing health care, finance, and auto, adding $3.8 trillion debt in just 36 months, et cetera, et cetera. That makes him a dictator in all but name. And after November 6th, he will earn that name. But waking people up is almost an impossibility. Even good conservative Republicans think of him as a boilerplate leftist. He is not. If you've read his books, I've read each one of them three times. I've been studying this man. He's doing what he wants to do. These are not just leftist policies.
No, as a matter of fact, Ron, he said right before the election, the world heard it. I'm going to fundamentally change America. He said it to the Union. He said it to Acorn. He said it to those people, and nobody listened to him. And if we watch what's going on right now, We are slowly, economically, we're melting. And we are melting in such a way that we're not going to be able to keep our defenses up against anyone else. And this country is going to be a Middle Eastern country if we're not very careful and if something doesn't happen. I'm sorry to say what I just said, but there's so much truth in that.
Well, you're right, and we're such slow learners. You know, socialism is the least of our fears, although most Americans, when they finally start thinking, they think socialism is the worst that can happen. You know, why would we think Obama and his Marxist zombies that are insatiable and addicted to lust for power would be different than Hitler, Stalin, Mao, or Pol Pot eventually? You know, they have a short time to replace our freedoms with serfdom, and you saw the results that these dictators that I just mentioned brought about. You know, when you try to take 300 million Americans that have had 235 years of freedom and transfer them to tyranny, it can become very ugly.
Well, one of the things that I do know is if you take a look at ex-servicemen here in the United States, if you take a look at the amount of hunters in the United States, you're looking at literally millions, and that in and of itself is a military force. That's a force to be reckoned with. That's one of the things that the other countries realize about us. Unless we dilute it, unless they take our guns away, you're not going to stop us, and you're not going to take us over. You still got that at the core heart of who we are. And when people start to forget, it's time that maybe we said who we are. I don't want to see blood on the street, and I don't want to shoot anybody. But the point of contention is it's the culture that we have lived with, that we have learned to be with, that's being attacked right now.
Now, we have seen the best of America, and like you just said, yes, I would say there is a minimum of 25 million of what I call the remnant. They are truly good Americans that either learned about America from their dad or they're old enough to have seen it themselves, like I have and probably you have. You know, a lot of people ask me if I see any hope. My fear is, yes, we have this huge remnant, and like you, because I was a combat medic in Vietnam, I don't want to see bloodshed, but our problem is we have no Cincinnatus. If you're familiar with who he was, he was a Roman in 458 BC that saved Rome, but he had a quality that nobody seems to have nowadays, that's benevolent. He resigned his dictatorship and saved Rome all in 16 days, but I don't, you know, you have to have a leader. No matter how many good people you have, you must have a leader, and I don't see a Cincinnatus arising from our midst to march 10 million of our remnant to Washington and forcing us kicking and screaming back to a constitutional republic. That Cincinnatus appears, I'm afraid they will. People like Obama will get more serious about taking this country away from us forever, because once it's gone, the United States will never return. It can't.
No. As a matter of fact, I've seen enough of this world. I've watched the transition. I graduated high school a year before you did, so we're right around that same place.
You sound so young.
Oh, no, I'm a year older than you are. I'm looking at all this. I've got the information here. But when it really comes down to, I was born in 42, November.
Yes.
But when it really comes down to it, that, you and I both, from the, as old as we are, we have seen the transitions. You saw Korea. We weren't old enough to do anything. You saw Korea. You saw Nam. You saw the changes in the 60s, you know, with the peace marches and the rest of it and so on and so forth. And then little by little, the transition into what's going on today. And we see time and again, people from other countries want to come in. This is the question that I have. And for the life of me, I don't get this one. Somebody runs from another country because they want to come here and have the good life. So if you come here to have the good life, why would you try to make this country like the one that you ran away from? I think that in and of itself is the problem. We have got so many different cultures here that it's very confusing for somebody to say who's an American anymore. And when you start taking the flag down, not saying the Pledge of Allegiance, going through all of those things that are anti-American, I don't quite get it. I'm old school. I'm a former Marine, and I love my country.
Well, you're right. My uncle's in the Chosin Reservoir. My Uncle Woody was killed in the airdrop over Arnhem. And the last Martin to die was one of the 18 Rangers in Black Hawk Down. It was my cousin Jimmy, first cousin. You know, your question is, why do they come here and try to change us? That is a lot, I would say that's about 5 or 10% of what I wrote about in my book is multiculturalism, affirmative action, diversity, political correctness. All of these things have just run amok. They have went too far. You know, this country is not great because we all diversified and went our separate ways. It is great because a few great people like Jefferson, Ben Franklin, Washington, they had a unique idea that produced the most amazing man-made system of governance ever in 6,000 years. And, you know, Thomas Jefferson, it all comes down to such simple advice that our founders gave us. When Thomas Jefferson said to refresh the tree of liberty from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants, he wasn't bloodthirsty. He was just a great rational man, and he knew that when you separate the three powers of our system of governance, one of the powers will try to dominate the others, and that's when you have to first try to solve the problem peacefully. Then if you have to, perhaps you have to knock a few people off. But it's worth it to get back, you know, the system that they founded. But we didn't do that. We let our system fester and rot from within for at least 100 years. That's the figure I use, starting with Woodrow Wilson. But we let it go too far until now. We're not on the slippery slope. We slipped off of it, and I don't know if we can get it back.
But it even brings it to our streets in the inner cities today and around the inner cities. I remember a time in this world, this America that you and I were brought up in, you could walk down the street at 12, 1 o'clock in the morning and never think of somebody's going to pull over and hurt you. When you were a kid, did you know anybody with a gun in school?
Well, I'll tell you what, this is really strange, but we could actually take guns to show and tell. That's how little we feared. And we never had anybody in school get shot.
No, but it was a different story. It wasn't bringing a gun as a gang gun. You're going to go out
no,
and shoot,
to shoot somebody. Oh, never.
No. That's what I mean when you didn't. There weren't guns in school. You got in a fight with a kid. Maybe you got a bloody nose. You became best friends, and it was over with.
That's right.
We moved to a society today that there are people getting killed in the schools or people getting killed on the streets. And nobody seems to want to take over. If the police get involved, then there's something wrong with them, and you sue the police department. It's just absolutely run amok at this stage of the game. And quote-unquote, we do need a leader. We need somebody to appear on the horizon to be able to get us back to where we were, or a semblance of it at least.
Well, if it doesn't happen very soon, then it, just like my book says, it is over. Because I really don't feel like we have much longer. In fact, I say that there will be no 45th president because nobody, there is no countervailing force against Obama. There is a fear among all of the leaders, whether it's the GOP or even among Democrats. Nobody will confront this man. Every president we've had has had enumerated powers, of course, by the Constitution. but few of them have used the unenumerated supreme imperial power of the presidency. This guy has done it, and he will do it. I documented, I think, and you know of them too, it's not a secret, I think there's at least like 42 different times this man has either refused to enforce legally enacted legislation or took it up on himself to bypass legislation, such as the moratorium on drilling in the Gulf and the Defense of Marriage Act. This man, like I said before, is a dictator. And if he has not stopped, power corrupts, and he will not stop.
No, by the way, I truly believe if he gets in next time also that you're right. I don't think we'll see another president after that, because if you truly look at what's going on right now, there's a lot of power going on. There's a civilian army starting to be picked up and yada, yada, yada. I mean, this list goes on, and I don't understand how there's so many people that are just blindsided by this. They just don't want to see it.
Well, part of it is fear, and part of it is something that nobody talks about on television or radio, but about 25% of my book is about it. It's called The Black Imbroglio. Everybody is, you know, used to the IRS was the most feared word or initials. Race, to be called a racist, is now the most feared. And,
sure.
And just like Sheila Jackson Lee, and other black leaders, any criticism of Obama for anything, even these wild violations that he makes, all of a sudden the word racist appears. Everything is racism. And, and I trace, you know, this back to 846 A.D., you know, when the black Berbers of Africa enslaved 1.5 million white folks. You know, slavery, none of us want to be slavery, but slavery was never a racist issue. In other words, there were not whites in the United States that said, I hate black guys, so I'm going to make a slave out of them. It's always been an economic issue. Whether blacks own slaves or whether whites own slaves, you know, we need to get over this.
Oh, by the way, Ron, I completely agree. We're running out of time. It's not the subject matter, but we're right at the bottom of the hour. Website we can find you at and get more information.
Yes, sir. I would appreciate it. The name of the website is itsstillover.com. Itsstillover.com, and it's 432 pages, and there's no filler. There's no wasted space. It'll tell you where we are. And where we are going if we don't wake up.
Wonderful. Hey, Ron Martin, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you. You have a good night.
You too. Good night.
Good night. They're longing to see.
There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice. Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Susanna Barlow with us. She's the author of What Peace there may be. And it's a memoir. She is the, listen to the numbers, she's the 23rd child of 46 children, the quintessential middle child growing up in a fundamentally religious home shaped her life, her values, and her views on literally everything. Although she's no longer affiliated with any polygamous groups or on a religious level, she's surrounded by family and friends who are practicing polygamists. And let's say, Susanna, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you.
Oh, and by the way, what is it like to grow up in that world when everything around you isn't like that world?
Well, I think that the isolation provides a sense that that world is all there is, that there really isn't anything but that world. And I think the isolation was a very necessary part of the religious mindset that my parents embraced, because without it, you would have a continual conflict between what we considered the outside world and our inner world. And
now,
so growing up isolated was just part of it. So my world was the only world, and I wasn't really in conflict with anything else.
Now, by the way, what's it like to be the 23rd child of 46 children? 46 children. There must be, I can't even fathom what that would be like. How does the child individually become recognized, become somebody? It seems like you'd be swallowed up.
Well, we were just numbers of children, and you were always looking for ways to make you stand out just a little bit from the crowd, be a little bit different, maybe be able to do some certain skill that set you apart from the others. Anytime you could do something that was an artistic talent, like maybe you could play the piano, you could become the piano player. Or maybe you're someone that could cook really well, and so you would be the daughter that could cook. And so rather than being individual and unique as a person, just for being who you are, you had to seek out a skill that set you apart from others so that you could find value in what you did rather than who you are.
Now, when we talk about the word abuse, and that's something that you've spoke about and that you've been an activist against, is abuse just sexual abuse, or is abuse something completely different than most people think?
Well, I think abuse covers a broad range of behaviors. And any time another person tries to control or take the power away from another individual, that's abuse. And that can be emotional abuse, that can be sexual abuse, religious abuse. I think that there's just a wide range of abuses. Anytime another person tries to take power away from somebody else, that's abuse. And it was rampant in our family. I think that culturally, human beings tend to abuse one another. And it's something that we have to become aware of, our tendency to want to hurt somebody else in an effort to gain for ourselves. I think that's the dark side of human nature, for sure.
Sure. But how do you function in a family, when I say a family, not as a child, but as a mother, let's say, and dad has got four or five women living in the same house. How do you deal with that? What happens to relationship? What happens to falling in love? Or do you, quote-unquote, just become a piece of property and function the way you're supposed to?
Well, I think that, and this is important to know, that the idea of relationship within the polygamous culture, any relationship, is very different. The concept of relationship is very different. The idea of falling in love was never part of the equation. That was never part of a relationship. It was never considered. It was never thought about. It was never anticipated. Or for many women, it was never even something that they conceived of. And so the idea of a relationship with a man was very, very different than you or I might think about that. And so it wasn't so much as how do I relate to this person, but rather
am I supposed to be married to this person? I mean, that was the all-important question. Does God approve of my being with this man or woman? And
no, but,
as a child, I had the same feeling with my own parents.
But when you come down to it, and there's, you know, a polygamous relationship, then what does that say about the role of a woman in that kind of a relationship? What is the role of the woman? It sounds as if it's to serve, and that's it.
Absolutely, that was absolutely the role of women. Service was valued, highly esteemed within the culture, and it wasn't just serving men; it was serving. Serving your community, serving God, serving your leader, whoever that may be. And in the polygamous culture, it's a strong patriarchal culture for certain. And so men do have a dominant role, and in many situations, the women are subjugated. There's no question about it.
Yeah. No, no. Was it Warren just recently? Recently was... went on trial, and it was for sexual abuse and so on and so forth. How can, in this country, with the laws that we have, how can polygamy, quote-unquote, live? How can it survive? How can it flourish?
Well, I think the reason that is because Warren Jeffs is an example of an extremely delusional, dysfunctional derelict of even the polygamous culture. I mean, he's completely a stain on many of those the polygamous groups that are active and participating in the polygamous relationships.
Yeah.
That Warren Jeffs is just a bad word. I mean, he represents everything that's wrong, that can go wrong when a person is unable to deal with the responsibilities and the temptations of a polygamous relationship.
Now, when we deal with the temptations of a polygamous relationship, you get a young woman, a girl. How old is the average before a girl is put through the sex, I'm going to call it process, before it's time for her and that's the end of it, she's serving. How old, on average, are the women?
Well, I think it differs from different groups have different attitudes about how old a girl should be before she gets married. And I think that typically all of the groups consider the girl to be of marriageable age much younger than our modern mainstream society does. But I would say average probably 17 or 18 is probably the average. You got some groups that feel that once a girl hits 14, 15, she should be put through the machinery that's going to lead her toward marriage. And
okay.
You have other groups that really don't encourage marriage until after the girl has received a college education. So you really have quite a diverse attitude about the marriage ages. So
but
I think the media promotes just the idea that all the polygamous cultures, all the polygamous groups, rather, really promote underage marriages, and that's just not the case. There are some that very much promote it and practice it, and then there are others that just don't.
Okay, but are the women told this is who you're going to marry? You're old enough. You're his now. Is that the way it works?
There are some groups that do arranged marriages, yes. And then there are others that do not, that don't promote that at all. So some of them, they are allowed to date and get to know each other as long as they date within the group. So as long as you're dating another young man or married man, it's allowed, then you're free to date whomever you please. But yes, there are different ways in which people get together in marriages according to each different group. But there are definitely groups that promote arranged marriages.
There is something obviously called bigamy, and it's against the law to be in one of those relationships when you've got two or three husbands, two or three wives, whatever the case may be. So how is it possible, and this is just a question, how is it possible to live in this country, in this world, and be a bigamist, be a polygamist, and at the same time you're breaking the law, but nobody's coming in to get you?
Well, I think it's been a sticky legal issue for a long time. Polygamy has been around in America since the 1840s. And so we're talking about 150 to 160 years that this has been practiced. And so to try to bring legal action against it has always created issues and problems. For one thing, it's technically not bigamy because every man is only legally married to one woman, and they are not legally married to more than one woman. All the other wives are taken as what's referred to as a spiritual wife, or there is a religious ceremony that unites that woman to the man, but there is no legal connection. So technically, all the other wives, no matter how many a man takes within a polygamous relationship, he is only legally married to the first wife.
Okay, so that's
really... In that regard, it's not technically bigamy and can't effectively be prosecuted as bigamy. And believe me, the law has tried to do that, and there has just been one failure after another in the past.
Yeah, because if legally you're not married to someone, then you are, quote-unquote, in a legal monogamous relationship. Not necessarily a physical relationship, but a monogamous relationship, because sex at the age of consent is not against the law. Marrying more than one person is against the law, so I can see it. If they're a spiritual wife, there's nothing legal. If there's nothing legal, you can't do anything with it.
Right. So it's been very difficult for them to prosecute on the grounds of bigamy, as well as the consent of both parties agreeing to the arrangement. Whereas usually the bigamy is where the women are completely unaware that they're legally married to the same man. So there are some differences in that regard. And so I think the way that law enforcement has approached this complicated issue has been to focus on abuses that are occurring within the polygamous groups, and that hopefully that will begin to weed out some of the crime and some of the other, the backward nature of some of these groups, and help integrate them into society in a more healthy way.
Now, also, when we're dealing with this, I pick the book up, I read it page by page, cover to cover. Well, Susanna, what's my takeaway? What do I, Michael Ray, get out of this book? What's the core message that you want this audience to know?
I think the most important message I wanted to share in writing my book is to connect to the human being that's behind the mask, the polygamous child or the polygamous wife, or, you know, in my case, the Gentile, the outsider, to break down those barriers and to see each other as human beings, and that we're all in this world struggling to make the best of the lives that we've been given and the circumstances that we're in. There's so much judgment and hatred and misunderstanding that I really wanted to bring down the stereotypes and the walls. And while I'm in no way in my book make the practice of polygamy a positive experience, because it wasn't for me. It was very, in many ways, it was very painful and destructive. But we're still human beings, and
sure,
we need to set aside all of those judgments and recognize each other, no matter what our backgrounds, as human beings first. And that's really one of the most important messages I wanted to convey.
Did you keep a relationship? I don't mean a physical relationship, but did you keep a relationship with the group itself?
Well, individuals within the group, but not the group as a culture or a religion. I was very much ostracized from that. Obviously, when I left, I would become a bad influence on other members. But that's my family. I mean, these are friends and family members that I've known my whole life. And so I have maintained relationships with individuals that are practicing polygamists, and I value that connection that I still have with them. And I think it keeps me objective and open-minded toward the real core issues. And it's so easy to just become polarized in your views and just look at the whole polygamous culture as just a cesspool of crime and negativity. And it helps me keep a balanced perspective and a much more objective one.
Susanna Barlow, we're just about out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
I do, SusannaBarlow.com. And
wonderful.
I have a YouTube video, and I've got all kinds of stuff to read, sample chapters from my book. You can buy the ebook on my website, as well as paperback and hardcover copies of the book as well.
Got it. Hey, Susanna, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
It's my pleasure.
Take care. Good night.
Thank you.
As they say in this biz, that's all there is. There isn't any more. We've shared a moment. And as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
Friends. Your cheers and laughter will linger after they've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do again, and the evening